Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In case you hadn't noticed, traditional advertising is going away fast and taking an era with it. Newspapers are bleeding out. Once mighty Condé Nast just shut down Gourmet and Modern Bride magazines. Not enough ads. Marketing and promotion are flooding into the still wild territory of the digital world with blogs and tweets and text promoting brands. Now the FTC wants bloggers to fess up about freebies and cash when they review products. Privacy advocates are crying foul over marketers who track your behavior online. It's a revolution mid-stride. This hour, On Point, the end of advertising and what comes next. Joining me first today from San Francisco is Ryan Single, reporter at Wired Magazine. He's been covering the new Federal Trade Commission guidelines for bloggers. Ryan, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Tell us why the FTC is paying attention to bloggers.
Well, the FTC is worried that in a kind of the new era of social media, where you have Facebook and reviews online, that marketers are finding a way to confuse consumers who read a review online and don't know whether that's a legitimate kind of word-of-mouth endorsement from somebody who just really liked that new detergent, or if it's somebody who the company paid.
How much of this is going on that makes it worth the FTC paying attention to? I mean, how much are, big companies, small companies, encouraging, paying, what incenting bloggers to write about their products?
There's a decent amount. There's a company that's kind of the best-known company is called Pay Per Post, and they pay bloggers to review things. They try and play fair and say, you know, we don't care what you write about this product, but, you know, we just want you to review it. And then there's just a lot more kind of freebies that have traditionally been given to normal media outlets. That are going to people who have started their own blogs or their own publications. So, for example, go and look at wine blogs. There's a lot of wine bloggers out there, people giving opinions of, you know, the bottles that they had the night before, and many of them now are just getting samples in the mail.
So the fear is if somebody keeps shipping you bottles of wine, you're going to write pretty nice things about it, whether you really think it's great or not.
That's true. I mean, I think it's human nature. When somebody gives you something, you feel a little bit of gratitude. So The question is, you know, does it really make a difference to a reader or somebody trying to make a purchase decision whether or not they know that person got something free or not?
It's amazing that this has risen to such a scale that the Federal Trade Commission is now involved, but it is. What do the new guidelines say broadly, Ryan?
They're a little bit odd. So they apply mostly to people who are bloggers or people who want to write reviews on Amazon or even on Facebook. And it basically says that if you kind of have a sponsorship relationship with a company, you need to disclose that. It doesn't say exactly how you disclose that. But basically, if you get something free at the supermarket, you know, somebody hands you a little small pouch of dog food and you take it home and your dog really likes it and you write it up, you're fine. The FTC isn't going to come after you. But if you're, you know, if you're a dog blogger, you write about your dog all the time and you have a big audience, and then you start getting freebies and you start reviewing them and you keep them, then the FTC might come knocking on your door.
It was probably hard enough for the FTC and the federal government to track truth in advertising when it was, you know, big Madison Avenue companies. And how do they possibly stay on top of this with who knows how many bloggers are out there?
Well, there's a difference between what their rules are and what the reality is. So what will probably happen here is what has happened with telemarketing and other kinds of, you know, scams, is that the FTC will find someone who is violating these rules in a big way and will make an example of them and will fine them or get them to agree to change their conduct, and they'll make a big show of it. And that kind of sets the rules of the road for everybody. And that's not a bad way to enforce this, because, you know, nobody wants the FTC to be looking at every Facebook page, and the FTC doesn't have the manpower to do that.
And at the same time, Ryan, there's a move afoot to look into privacy and how consumers' tastes and interests and behaviors being tracked online as they move around. Is there? Do you see what action in the offing to protect consumer privacy, or is this just the new economy, privacy, you know, invading privacy or piercing it is the way that people get served marketing?
Well, oddly, this is also the FTC's purview. So they've been holding some hearings. They're going to write some new guidelines on kind of what disclosures have to happen. And I think this is going to be good for the market as well. So basically, the FTC is going to look at companies like Facebook, companies that also that serve ads that have little tracking cookies, that they want to know you better so they can serve you better ads, and when they serve you better ads, they can charge more money. And that's not a bad thing. It's just right now most people don't understand the amount of collection that's going on, and they have no way really of getting rid of that info or opting out.
It's huge, and no doubt will get bigger. Is anybody thinking that a real cap is going to be put on that, or is that just the future of marketing, promotion, advertising?
Well, Congressman Markey, who's a fairly powerful powerful congressman from Massachusetts, mm-hmm. he's talking about putting a limit and making it so that you have to opt in. You know, company has to ask you, is it okay if I track you online? That the advertising industry, you say, would just kill online advertising. And we're going to see something in the middle. We'll probably see either really strong voluntary guidelines from the advertising industry, some guidelines from the FTC, or even congressional action. Somewhere in there, we're going to see some rules, and that'll be good, because once everyone has to play by the same set of rules, then you don't have to worry about your competition knowing more than you do. Right? Everybody has to play the same way.
Ryan Singel at Wired Magazine in San Francisco. Thank you very much for joining us, Ryan.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
We're talking today about the collapsing world of advertising and the struggle over what will replace it. A lot of blogging going on right now, talking about products, what's what, what's good, what's not. Joining us right now from Sacramento, California, is one of those bloggers, quite a prominent one, Christine Young. She's a so-called mommy blogger. She blogs about her family at FromDatesToDiapers.com. She's a member of a group of moms organized by Walmart to review products and is also paid by Johnson & Johnson to review their baby products on YouTube. Christine Young, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think of the new FTC guidelines? Are they going to crimp your style as a blogger? You must be flooded with products. I mean, everybody seems to want you, mommy blogger, to be talking about what they want to sell.
Right, and that's definitely true. But you know what? I've had a disclosure policy in place on my site since I began reviewing products that basically just states that I do receive products for review. I don't get paid for my reviews, but I've always been really clear with my readers that I do receive product in exchange for a review.
But how do we know that you stay on the straight and narrow? I mean, Frito-Lay and Johnson & Johnson and Walmart, I mean, you've got an appeal right on your website saying, we love PR, you know, fly us around, take us to conferences, take us out there. Do you have a garage full of payola from these guys? And how do you keep from being influenced by that influx?
Well, sure, and that's a very valid question. We do have a room that's kind of set aside to organizing our loot, so to speak. But my readers have grown to trust my opinion. They know that I am authentic, that I will only discuss products that work well for our family. I've got 6 kids. So my goal with FromDatesToDiapers.com is to kind of talk about the products and services that make family life fun. So I'm really not in the business of going on my site to bash products or to, you know, speak negatively about products. Therefore, I only write about the products that we use, the services that we use, and those that make family life fun. So, you know, I basically have established this rapport with my readers, with my visitors, that they can trust. They value my opinion.
Well, they can sort of trust, Christine. I mean, in a way, the manufacturer can't lose by showering loot, as you call it, on you, because if you don't like it, you're not going to write about it. That's hardly like Consumer Reports.
Correct, yeah. I don't tout FromDatesToDiapers.com as a Consumer Reports-like site. There are plenty of them out there, but I basically just write from a mom's perspective. Mm. I talk about those services that we do use, those products that we love. So, you know, you're right. In a way, these companies really don't have anything to lose in sending me these products, because I simply just won't write about them if I don't like them.
You're the kind of influencer that they are increasingly coming to really care about. Do you see yourself as the future of advertising, marketing, of companies getting the word out about their products?
Well, you know, in a way I do. It's a little bit overwhelming to think that blogs are ultimately the new media. We are new media. We're social media, and we're, you know, the place that people turn to for real opinions and you know, authentic voices. So, you know, it's heading in that direction, and I think that, you know, it makes sense, because a mom who is looking for that perfect stroller, you know, when they're adding a, you know, a second baby to their family, they're going to turn to the moms who have had, you know, multiple children and have tried multiple strollers to see, you know, what best works for them. So it does. It makes sense.
How are we going to keep you honest? Or do you feel no obligation to be any more, you know, dutifully honest than Madison Avenue was when it was pumping out all of its glossy images?
You know, I have a certain, you know, code of ethics that I abide by. I won't lie to my readers. My readers have become my friends. I've built a community within, you know, FromDatesToDiapers.com simply by, you know, posting my honest opinion and things that happen in my family. So, you know, I see my readers more as, you know, as friends than I do just simply as readers.
And Walmart sees you as the path to those quote-unquote friends.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have worked with Walmart as one of their 11 moms. Walmart occasionally does send us product to review, but mostly, you know, my relationship with Walmart is, you know, as a panel of moms who, you know, who work together to kind of just get our, you know, feet into this whole social media.
Got a couple of great guests joining us right now. James Othmer joins us from Washington, former creative director at advertising giant Young & Rubicam, author of Adland, Searching for the Meaning of Life on a Branded Planet. James Othmer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from National Public Radio's own On the Media, we're joined by Bob Garfield, ad critic and editor-at-large for Advertising Age for 24 years. His new book is The Chaos Scenario. You can see a few chapters of it at our website, onpointradio.org. Bob Garfield, it's very good to have you.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
A familiar voice. Give us the big picture, Bob. What is going on here?
The big picture is we're all doomed. We may be in the brave new world, but the cowardly old world is in mid-collapse. And it's all because of the digital revolution. It has destroyed that beautiful, beautiful, beautiful symbiosis between mass media and mass marketing that has given us so much news and information and entertainment for about 350 years. They are decoupled, and one of the big victims will be Madison Avenue.
So what's doomed, I guess, Madison Avenue is one piece of it. The other piece of it is like Gourmet Magazine and Modern Bride and Newspapers in Trouble and a whole lot more. You're saying everything that traditional ad industry supported with its dollars and its even creativity, even if it was for cigarettes or whatever, that's at risk too in this epic change.
Oh, yeah, it's all at risk. I mean, you know, apart from the fact that maybe people applaud Tony the Tiger when he goes by in the Madison Avenue parade every ad week in September, nobody's going to really miss the advertising itself all that much. But it has subsidized and underwritten our entire culture and in many ways our democracy for going on four centuries. And when that collapses, you know, it's going to be hard to replace, and in fact impossible.
But things are growing up already. Green shoots, to pull in a phrase from another forum here. I mean, bloggers and all the rest. We just talked with one. Is this the new way? We're going to be looking for individuals sitting out there in their basement, you know, hawking this or that, or at least giving us their opinion, and that's the marketing of the future, Bob?
Well, I don't think mommy bloggers are going to define the future, and I certainly hope it isn't the sort of buzztitution that the FCC is now cracking down on. But to the extent that the new media world can replace what we're losing, yes, online is where it's going to happen. And the first half of my book, The Chaos Scenario, talks about the collapse and why it happened and why it's happening and where it will leave us. The second half is about what I call the art and science of listenomics. And it's about, in a connected world, institutions, whether Procter & Gamble or the Vatican or the U.S. government, have to stop dictating with a megaphone and start paying very strict attention to the group formerly known as the audience.
James,
the audience now has the power.
Empowered audience. James Othmer, you spent many years sort of speaking down the megaphone to that big media audience out there, bringing them images and ideas and brand messages. Do you buy this view that advertising is done, dead, on its way out?
Yeah. I'm a survivor of that collapse, and I don't have a large enough ego, and I wasn't talented enough to make any correlation between me leaving and advertising failing. But I do agree. There's chaos. There's going to be huge casualties in the large agency world, the holding company world. But on the other hand, in Adland, I talk about the world that collapsed, but I also go out into this new digital world and spoke to more than 20 different new idea factories that are at work and doing amazing things. And these are companies that embrace the chaos. They think it's the greatest thing. They think this confluence of new advertising, the digital world, and the openings that the broken models of music and print and network television, the movie industry, they think that there's myriad opportunities to do great things, make great work. What I couldn't figure out is how are they going to make money doing it, but I did see some amazing creative being done at places like Droga5, Barbarian Group, Big Spaceship. The big question for me remains, how do they monetize it? How does it make money, and does it really work? But there is a whole other world out there that thinks that the future of advertising couldn't look better.
Bob, why won't the chaos be great?
Well, because the revolution will not be monetized. James has identified the central problem that for a few reasons. I don't want to get too bogged down in economics, but there's two problems that will bedevil these idea factories that James has discussed. First, the advertising economy itself is going to cannot be revived because in a world of extraordinary glut. The internet is the greatest repository of content in all of human history. That creates with it the greatest supply of advertising inventory in all of human history, which, of course, in a glut of supply, drives down prices. So advertising won't fetch enough money for publishers and broadcasters to pay for the high-quality content we've all grown accustomed to. So that's problem number one. Mm. And problem number two is the ad agency business has been essentially earning its living as off of a percentage of the media buy for more than 100 years. And there is no way for them to get paid for all these great ideas in anywhere near the scale that they're accustomed to. Their business model does not adapt to the new world. So unless they can, start generating lots of fees as consultants, and a few will, they're in trouble. And of course, the vast, vast majority will not be able to make the nut.
Old media won't be happy. Madison Avenue may not have the same bank to take home. But what about consumers here? Let's hear from some of them. Columbia, South Carolina. Spencer, you're on the air, Spencer.
Hi. I was just pointing out that I'm a 24-year-old, and I really trust my local blogger, if you will, more than I would ever trust, like, a 30-second TV or radio spot, just because I hear from them, like, on a weekly basis and, come to trust them. It's like the new word of mouth.
But you can't know a blogger who's writing about everything you want to buy, or can you? I mean,
you don't really listen to a blogger that talks about everything. You talk to Mommy Blog about her strollers, and then, a video game blogger about his games.
How do you know that Mommy Blog isn't carving her opinions to, despite what she tells us, or, someone like her, to reflect how much loot she's got in the garage from that company, or even cash?
Well, I think that most people can tell when somebody's sold out, if you will, because mm-hmm. they're going to be advertising the big ticket items more than some really great small find.
You'd actually be surprised. People will hoard themselves for a pack of gum. I don't quite understand the economics or the mentality of it, but I don't think it's the size of the ticket on the item. But the caller makes an interesting point, and that is we do, by our natures, trust one another, our acquaintances, our family, our friends, our colleagues, far more than we've ever trusted Madison Avenue. And the future, the Listenomics future, is all about institutions harnessing and exploiting that trust, not to mention the vast aggregated IQ and energy and passion of the group that was formerly the mute hoi polloi. These are your stakeholders, your constituencies who you can now in a two-way conversation really get a lot of value from.
But Spencer says he's more likely to end up, as I hear him, looking for a local product, a small manufacturer, than a big one. James, do the new dynamics in this era push against big producers, big manufacturers? Just if you're going to have local bloggers talking about, you know, cool stuff that they like, maybe made in their backyard, does it break up our economic model a little bit even?
Well, if monetization is a key word on the economic side, authenticity is probably the biggest catchphrase or issue at stake right now. I think of the internet as a street. You walk down the street. Are you going to, you know, buy tickets to a concert from a scalper or go through a bona fide way to do this? Are you going to buy the Rolex from a guy out of a suitcase on the corner of Madison Avenue, or will you go to a store? So online, unfortunately, right now, people think that anything that's on the internet has some kind of veil of authenticity to it, and it's not necessarily the case. So I think bona fides and figuring out what's true and what's authentic. And the blogger who was on earlier made a good point. She does have disclosure, so that gives her pluses in some ways. And I think there's a generation now that understands that there's a new dynamic in place and there's a different game being played, and the old model isn't working. So this is the way it works. But people will have to figure out, brands will have to figure out, consumers will have to figure out what's authentic and what's not. Is that a great skater video that I just saw on YouTube, or is it a badly disguised apparel commercial? But it's getting hard to tell right now.
But it sounds, when you talk about bona fides, like you're maybe trying to work your way back to Madison Avenue being the big authority that puts the imprimatur on, you know, what's credible and what's not. Spencer is saying he sees more bona fides coming up from, you know, somebody local, somebody who he thinks...
I think that that's great that he finds that, and I think that that's valid and that's okay. I think it's a similar situation that journalism faces. If you have a blogger, who's authentic? How do they establish themselves as a credible writer who has trusted sources, gets their mm-hmm. facts straight, isn't libelous? It will have to shake itself out. I have a friend at YNR who tells me that the internet will ultimately reveal everything. Unfortunately, when messages are coming at us, you know, millions at the speed of light, it's hard to vet everything that quickly. But ultimately, it will, and bigger brands, if they're putting messages out on the internet, they will be revealed as frauds, dishonest, or reputable. And I think if he wants to go at it through that small way, that's great. The great part about the internet and the digital mm-hmm. model is there's myriad choices. To mm-hmm. Bob's point, what does this mean for the bigger agencies, and what does this mean for the industry as a whole? There's a lot of chaos out there.
Sounds like it may mean the end for a bunch. Jason in Storrs, Connecticut. Jason, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a psychology student, and I know that learning about the history of psych, modern advertising techniques are descended from psychologists who are just trying to make a buck. And I wonder if maybe we've outgrown those techniques, and maybe it's up to modern academic types to figure out ways to target modern products to an audience that doesn't really fit that mold anymore.
Bring a different part of human nature to play in selling. What do you say, Bob Garfield? Not psychology, truth telling.
I don't think that modern advertising really does derive much from psychology. Hmm. I mean, you'd be surprised how crude and primitive the industry is. It flirted.
A lot of psychology is pretty crude and primitive.
Yes. it flirted with this sort of pseudoscience in the 50s and the 60s, but it's pretty much been abandoned for the altar of. Pyrotechnics and punchlines. Believe me, nobody is manipulating you. Nobody has gotten inside your psyche very successfully. And the problems with advertising have zero to do with the techniques of advertising, and everything to do with the economic disruption brought on by the digital revolution.
But this is a real
revolution with real displacement. Industries are going to disappear. Millions of people will lose their livelihoods, including me, including you, Tom, most likely.
We're gone. We're done. We're toast.
Yes, and James, you know, he was in the agency business. He got out in the nick of time. This is a very serious matter, and the talk of psychology, frankly, is trivial in the face of it.
But Jason, Bob, seems to not be anticipating this with so much fury, saying that there may be other ways to communicate about products, to share messages about things people want to get informed about. I mean, maybe we go from manipulation to, if everybody's empowered and they can go wherever they want, maybe we go to more credible kind of information flows, Bob. Maybe that's not so bad.
Maybe. You know, I think in a listenomics world, what we're talking about is if you make good stuff and if you can generate enthusiasm among the people who use it, if you can persuade, you know, the public has always had this weird proprietary feeling about goods and services. They don't much like advertising, but they like products and services just fine.
That are good.
That are good, and you know, and they really believe they have a stake in them. I mean, just way before the internet, remember the diet, the new Coke fiasco in the mid '80s. Coca-Cola changed the flavor of Coke, and they had all this survey evidence that said yes, people undoubtedly by about 3-1 liked the new flavor more than the old flavor. And they asked them, and they made very carefully, and they dotted their I's and crossed their T's, and they introduced the new Coke, and people went nuts because the Coke asked the wrong question. They shouldn't have asked which one tastes better in a blind taste test. They should have said, do you want us fiddling with the flavor of Coca-Cola?
And the answer was a great big no.
No, because they thought it was, you know, it was their Coca-Cola as much as it was of the Coca-Cola companies. And hadn't Coca-Cola been telling them that for 100 years?
But in the new age, maybe we'll have 62 different kinds of cola and have whatever you want.
Well, I don't know, but what I do know is that you better stop treating your customers and your other audiences as if you're doing them a favor, because they have a stake in everything you do, and they can bring a lot to the party. But as I can tell you from personal experience, you do not want to alienate them, as Comcast learned the hard way.
Let me get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Tom, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling to talk about street teams, and I work in the record business, and about 20 years ago, the record labels realized that word of mouth was the most powerful way they could reach their fans, so they started creating street teams. It started with urban music and rap music, and basically the company hires a bunch of college students to go out and just talk up their artists. And now whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is left to be seen, but now the whole thing's moved online. So they have online street teams, and there are companies that actually, their whole model of their company and everything they do is based upon this notion of hiring street teams and rewarding and paying them.
Tom, our time is short before the break, but James Othmer, how about it? Can you see that as being a successor to Madison Avenue? What, hordes of teams sent out around the country just to talk it up on the street corner in a bar? Is that part of what comes next?
It's kind of like a performance art version of the mommy blogger. I don't think it's the future of Madison Avenue at all. I think it's an aspect of marketing. It's something that brands do. And I think advertising is a tension between art, commerce, and ethics. And when you start getting into, you know, people talking things up under the guise of being authentic and they're actually not, you're getting into some ethical gray area. And I think a brand, to Bob's point again, goes there at their own risk, because ultimately they're going to get outed. There could be some bad flashback their way if the wrong things are said or people feel like they've been duped. So I think it's a risky thing as well. Going out on the street and doing an immersive campaign or something that's very creative and guerrilla-like, an agency in London a few weeks ago did a pop-up agency. They realized that the old model of agency didn't work, so they just opened one up in a storefront on a sidewalk for a couple of days, did some work for people on the spot, and then moved on. That's interesting. It's creative. Is it the answer? I'm not sure, but street teams get into an ethical area that I'm not that comfortable with.
Bob, James, we have a lot of listeners who want in here. Matt in Providence, Rhode Island. Matt, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I think I want to back up what Bob was saying a little while ago about Coca-Cola, but extend it to the fact that, like, I know I'm part of the generation that now has sort of website affinity. You know, like, I have a lot of loyalty to these forums where I get information.
Mm-hmm.
And when I find that somebody's talking too much about a product on one of these things, I get really annoyed. And then I lose my loyalty, not my loyalty, but my trust in the website. I stop wanting to hear what people are saying to each other. I don't care if somebody has a product to endorse, but if they're being paid and I don't know, that's really annoying.
And you're annoyed because you fear they may have a financial interest in sharing a particular opinion.
Yeah, and it immediately destroys the worth of the forum. that, you know, I don't trust, I can't trust the information coming out of there anymore. It's not fun. We're not just shooting the breeze anymore. Suddenly somebody's trying to sell me something.
That may be, however, the future, if that's where advertisers or those with stuff to sell see their best path to you. Let me hold that and get another here, right here from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Robert, you're on the air.
Hello there. My comment is kind of along the lines of what the caller just said, but what I wanted to say is the reason that I feel like a lot of individuals are trusting these online bloggers is because we know for certain when I see an advertisement on a commercial, they're selling me a product.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I'm reading a forum, I don't know necessarily if that's their personal opinion or if that is them selling me a product. So it's kind of the lesser of two evils. I know one is definitely for manipulation, whereas the other could just be someone's comment or review.
There's a chance that it's legitimate and for real. Bob Garfield, what do you hear in these two? Matt is worried that he sees, you know, more what kind of bought and paid for opinion showing up in the forums. You hear our caller in Bowling Green saying, well, there's a better chance it's honest there than if it's Madison Avenue.
Right. That's why this stealth, this sleazy paper post stuff is not, really doesn't have much of a future. That's not the future of online marketing at all. Because, you know, for one thing, you can almost always tell, partly because these people are getting paid a little bit with every post, so they're cutting and pasting and putting the same, you know, inane
phrases,
expression
yeah.
of the
yeah,
same phrases. And, you know, you can, it just always sticks out like a sore thumb.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a writer, so I can coin an incredibly
that's
clever
else,
phrase.
Bob,
yeah,
it's good.
Well, you know,
it's great.
A gift.
I'm
what
jotting
can I tell
it
you,
down
Tom?
Now, okay.
And so, you know, and by the way, and as Matt said, there is a backlash. I mean, when you start seeing this stuff, you resent it and you stop trusting. And trust is what makes social media go round. So apart from the FCC's actions, just the ecosystem of the Internet, I think will quickly eradicate that kind of buzzstitution.
So if it's not a buzz that's driving marketing, do you see it all in this sort of behavior tracking code on the web that is following what every user, you know, seems to want or need or desire and just pinpoint that? What's the way?
Well, I think data mining is a big part of it. And, you know, in my view, it's really not as sinister as it may sound. I don't think we have to worry about a lot of big brothers out there. What we have to worry about on the Internet is not 1984. It's Lord of the Flies and the malicious behavior, not of Procter & Gamble, but of, you know, just ordinary Joes. But yes, your behavior, your surfing behavior is tracked on your browser. Cookies are being left behind. But, you know, they're not tracking you, Tom Ashbrook. They don't know your name. They just know that the person who is logged onto this browser does go here, doesn't go there, does seem to like this, has no interest in that. And to the extent that advertising does exist in the online world, you will be spammed less and be given relevant material more. I don't see that as a big problem. I'd rather see less spam and more advertising that has something to do with my life and interests. Privacy isn't really an absolute anyway anymore. We all surrender some of it for security. You know, when we travel, celebrities surrender it for celebrity. We all most of us surrender it when we go to the checkout aisle and get a few cents off on the clam chowder, and they know exactly how much Preparation H we've just bought, and they do know our names and addresses.
Oh, boy.
So, I wouldn't get too worried about what's happening to this data about us personally, because Procter & Gamble has no interest in you, Tom. Their interest is only in your
sale.
Purchasing behavior.
James Othmer, as an old world advertising guy, now looking at this new world, how do you see all the behavior and online tracking? Are you running movies in your head of little hooks you're going to throw out to people who meet a certain profile, and you'll have 72 different ads or 72,000 instead of one or two for a particular
product?
It's
just a more sophisticated way of gathering information so creatives and strategic people can think of ways to hook their brand up with people who might want it. Bob's correct. You may get less spam, or you may be delighted to find that they recommended something that you really do want and you weren't even sure about. For every one of those, I'm sure there'll be thousands of people who are outraged by having their data mined. What's more important is what brands do with this information and what kind of messaging they're going to put out, and will it be the future of advertising, and will it be a valid thing? It's moved on to engagement now is a word, and tomorrow it'll be another word. But you're no longer a captive consumer. You have a choice to, you know, flame, spam, delete, move on from any message, and it's incumbent upon brands to engage you. And they're doing a good job, but I think there's going to be an engagement threshold at a certain point. If a brand is advertising a sporting goods thing or a video game to you, that's one thing. But you know, you're willing to spend, you know, 6 hours online playing a game and doing a scavenger hunt and interacting with avatars. Mm-hmm. But is there an engagement threshold? Do you really want to interact with a toilet paper brand or a dental floss brand? So I think what they do with this information and the type of messages that evolve and come out of it will be the most interesting thing for the future of advertising.
Bob Garfield,
I have a complaint. I'm sorry, Tom.
All right, raise it. We can't stop anyone now. It's the new age.
Well, James previously had used the word chaos like clockwork every 2 minutes, which I thought was fantastic. So, James, please, just say chaos again, would you please? Because
he's moving on to Listenomics.
It's such a fantastic scenario.
No, but I hear him saying.
Are you going to get on me for saying engagement?
Yeah, Bob's got engagement. I hear James saying that there's still going to be a role for Madison Avenue. That engagement has its limits. That you're going to have brand management even now. That you still need the madmen in your corner. Correct me if I'm wrong, James. But Bob, do you see that there's still a Madison Avenue role here or not?
Well, there's some role. Marketing is not going to go away. In many ways, someone's going to have to figure out how to connect brands and consumers in a way that doesn't infuriate the consumers and bankrupt the brands. The question is whether it's the same category of people, whether it's the madmen who inhabiting advertising agencies, or whether it's digital consultants, whether it's in-house people. I think the advertising agency business is not very high on the list for those who are going to be doing this work in the future. They're doing it now, but they're not doing it that well, and their business model is not suited to it. And I would say the days of the madmen are quickly coming to an end.
Let's get a call from Austin, Texas. John, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I would take assertion with Bob Garfield's.
Exception.
Yes, sir.
With Bob Garfield's assertion that the media doesn't manipulate people, I would put it to him that you can't see a person on a magazine cover that's not airbrushed. People suffer from all sorts of image problems due to the kind of bodies and images that they see. There are germaphobes out there that the advertising mm-hmm. agencies play on. There are a lot of ads that exploit it with little images of germs running around and that sort of thing. That really gets to some people and creates phobias in a lot of people that are really irrational and unreasonable.
Can I just jump in here to say, you misunderstand me. I don't claim that the advertising and the media don't manipulate people. I'm just saying it has nothing to do with the current circumstances. It's always been true that the media sometimes behave poorly, advertising chief among them, but it has nothing to do with the collapse of the media and marketing infrastructure.
I heard John keying off your earlier comment saying it wasn't so much sophisticated psychology at work, but John, let me ask you, in Austin, do you see, I mean, I hear you saying Madison Avenue has played on all kinds of fear and psychology here. Do you see the future being better if marketing moves to the digital realm, John?
Well, I think that the areas that they've really figured out how to manipulate people and certain phobias and things, they've perfected it in some of the real hegemons in the media world, print, television, and radio. They're going to have to kind of, I believe, start from scratch to a degree in terms of figuring out how to make it play correctly in the digital world. People have a lot more of ability to kind of ignore the advertising that's targeted at them in the digital realm.
They can do that. On the other hand, a sophisticated marketer can send a little torpedo right into your particular psychology one day. Let's get a call from Natick, Massachusetts, and Steve. Steve, you're on the air.
Thanks very much, Tom. I spent my career in brand marketing, product management, building a number of brands with the conventional media that you're discussing.
Right.
And I am really concerned that it's going to be very difficult to build major brands using the kind of viral marketing we're talking about, because it just doesn't, you may be able to get to the consumer in many, many small ways, but you're not going to be able to have the major impact that advertisers once had through network television and focused media.
So is there a kind of wag the dog effect here, Steve, where a new arena for marketing means it shapes a different economy on the other side of production? Smaller producers, you can't have the giant brand anymore.
Well, that's right, but I'm not sure what's going to replace it. What's built our economy, whether we like it or not, mm-hmm. has been consumerism for the last 200 years. And if we don't have the ability, and the other thing that concerns me is that with advertising over time, there has been, and I certainly know working myself, a lot of regulation and determining what you can say and what you can't say.
Right.
That isn't true now with viral marketing. And at least I knew when I know when I see an ad, number one, that they can't claim anything that's not true.
Not for too long,
number
anyway.
Number two, that... Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
Not for too long, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. I mean, if you're blatantly lying at an ad, you're going to get sued.
Yeah.
That's not true with the kind of media that's going on now. And secondly, I know when I see an ad that I take it with a grain of salt. It's the marketer. It's the producer who's promoting it. I don't know that when I read a blog on the internet.
Steve, I appreciate your call. James Othmer, do you see consumerism going away with Madison Avenue? If you don't have Madison Avenue whipping up all those appetites, does consumerism go away with it somehow?
Oh, I hardly think so. We still watch more than 8.7 hours of television a day per household, so I don't think TV is quite gone yet. People are watching less commercials, that's true, and it's more difficult for a brand to kind of do a roadblock announcement of a new product and make a big splash with television. So they will have to reconfigure the mix and the marketing mix as things move forward. One thing that's really interesting is the madmen of tomorrow aren't going to be coming out of advertising agencies. I think the madmen of tomorrow who are going to master branding are the ones who best understand that it's digital, it's branding, but there's also three or four other industries that are at a crossroads also. And I think the ones who best understand where network television, where the film industry, where the music industry, where the print media industry is going, and figure out this confluence of branding and where all of these work together. And they're not just ad agencies are doing this. There's you know, idea factories and shops that are trying to figure out all of these models at the same time. And that's where I think the most interesting solutions are going to come from.
Bob, what do you see coming out of this revolution, this chaos, as your chaos scenario would have it? What's on the other side, or what emerges?
Well, I think the caller raised a very interesting question. I keep talking about the yin and yang of mass media and mass marketing, but in the absence of both of those, what does that mean for mass marketed brands? If Procter & Gamble creates a new product and nobody knows about it, is there any reason for a national brand?
I buy soap from my neighbor, maybe. They make it in the backyard.
Well, yeah,
is that what
maybe. This may mean that the Chris Anderson's long tail of products and services may come to the fore in the 21st century, and mass marketers like Procter and everybody else who's been living off of the efficiencies of mass media for so long, they may be left in the lurch. I'm telling you, economic disruption is the story, and I believe it will make this current, the recession of 2008 and 2009 seem like just a joke before long.
I guess we'll be talking about this for a long time, the end of mass media, the end of mass marketing. That's an unknown country for most Americans, but one that Bob Garfield says in his new book, The Chaos Scenario, we have moved into in no small part already. Bob Garfield from On the Media, and with the chaos scenario, we're really great to have had you today. Thank you so much for jumping on with us. Great to have you, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom. Thanks, James.
James Othmer, author of Adland, Searching for the Meaning of Life on a Branded Planet, longtime creative director at advertising giant Young and Rubicam. James, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, and thank you, Bob.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.